Surviving evidence. What you are about to hear is an incredible story. I hope if you're bundled up, you've got the sheets up to your neck. If you're driving around, make sure there's nobody in your back seat looking at you. Because this is an incredible story, and we'll get right into it in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. First of all, let me do the introduction. As a young college student, Chris DeCesare, his view of life was forever changed. Why? Because of a series of just horrific, horrifying events in and around his dorm room, C2, D1, at SUNY, at Genesco. That's the State University of New York. From early Feb through late April 1985, he and his college friends endured what is now referred to as the C2D1 haunting. Apparitions sighted, disembodied voices heard, moving objects witnessed, physical attacks, all became part of the ordeal suffered by Chris, who became the focal point of the haunting, and several of his classmates. Here he is on Coast to Coast. Whoa, I would not want to change places with you, Chris.
Well, good morning, George, and I understand.
Welcome to the program. And this is something that happened a long time ago, yet your book, Surviving Evidence, is just here. What took you so long?
Well, you know, I think that time allows you to look back with greater clarity. When you're in the midst of something emotional, you can't always make sense of that. And given decades to reflect back and have conversations, it's easier for me now to put some meaning to it and understanding to it.
I love when I talk to authors to ask them about the title of their book, how they picked it. Yours is Surviving Evidence. Tell me about that.
Well, exactly. You know, it's when people ask me what happened, they often ask, well, what are your proofs? What's the evidence that you have that these things actually occurred? And if you think about it, there are some surviving things like photographs or what they call EVPs, but for me, it's I'm the surviving evidence. I'm the one that went through this and my friends, and so I'm trying to, you know, share the experience in the best way I can, since in a way I am part of the evidence.
Yeah, you sure are. You sure are. So let's go back. The haunting took place around 1985. Tell me about what you're doing at that time and what's going on.
Well, that was a great year in 1984 for, I think, our country. The Olympics were in Los Angeles, and we did very well there. There was a feeling of patriotism. The president back then, he won 49 states, Ronald Reagan, so there seemed to be a sense of unity. It's very nice, and I was a young kid, and I had dreams of going to the Olympic Games and the marathon, and I was healthy and happy, and the most amazing thing about that is when this haunting arrived, it was the farthest thing from what I'd hoped for or what I expected.
And as a college student, what happened? Why you?
Well, I wish I knew. I wish I could tell you how that happens or why that happens. You know, people speculate, well, perhaps something happened in that place. Maybe someone is sensitive. Perhaps someone did something to call a spirit out that way. I don't know. This came from out of the blue. There was nothing that I had, to my knowledge, done or said or experienced that would have led to the trauma that would ensue once February hit. The only thing I can tell you is that Ed and Lorraine Warren, and probably your listeners know who they are.
I sure do.
They came to the college on January 30th, 1985, which is about 10 days before the haunting began, and they did a symposium and talked about their experiences. And I went because my friend next door wanted to go, and it was free. We're college kids.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave their presentation. It was amazing. She was very regal, and you know, he was like almost like a carnival barker and very entertaining. At the end of the presentation, you could go up and say hello to them. And I approached, and Lorraine wouldn't shake my hand. She said to me, "I don't want to know my future." And from that moment on, I don't know if she sensed something, life changed. And 10 days later, I'm in my room, and I began to hear this voice call my name, and then it took off from there.
And the room, of course, I assume the dorm room is C2D1. That's how it was numbered, huh?
Absolutely. It was actually an eerie hall, but 1E, not 2. It should have been 2, like the Great Lake. And it was the C building, the second floor, the D quad in the first room. And all throughout the haunting, we didn't use words like ghost or spirit or haunting. We just said, how are things in C2D1? Because back then, it was the occult, and you didn't talk about those things so much. And so that's how it became, I think, known as the C2D1 haunting.
You had other classmates with you?
Absolutely. You know, we there are 6 to 7 students in every quad. And unfortunately, I tried very hard, my roommate did, and some of our friends, to keep things quiet. But eventually, word got out, and the haunting began to spread through different buildings within the dormitory. So that was rough.
You've talked about fear before, Chris.
Yes.
What kind of fear did you feel in those days?
It was a paradigm shift for me. You know, I was brought up with empiricism in mind, Immanuel Kant, my dad was taught science, and everything had to be proven, where you could use telescope and you can see Mars and Venus, you can take a microscope and see microbes, but you really couldn't see ghosts. And so therefore, it wasn't something that was in my, you know, cook understanding. To actually, for the first time, see this thing, seeing it in terms of its graphic description wasn't as scary for me as the thought that, wait, I can't be seeing this, so if I am, then what else that I know is wrong? What in my life I've been taught can actually depend upon? And for a 19-year-old kid, that's earth-shattering.
Sure is. Thank you for signing the book, by the way. I get a kick out of that. Thanks. I collect
my
that.
My pleasure.
So those moments for you, what was exactly the first time that you were aware that there was a haunting going on, that, or something just wasn't right?
I think initially I was in denial. When I began to hear the whispering voices, my assumption was that it was some kind of practical joke. My dormitory were playing a joke, you know, and mm-hmm. I figured, well, if I can't hear them do it, I could forget about that. So I put some headphones on, and I played, this is old school, Sammy Hagar, Voice of America. I can't drive 55. And the problem was that in the headphones, over the music, I heard the voice again. And that, for me, was compelling. But I still thought, well, maybe someone rigged the headphones. The following day, when I saw this thing, the specter, standing in my room, that's when I realized that this wasn't a case of a gas leak. This wasn't a case of some drugs in my food or mass hysteria. There's something there. And I have to tell you, I was not a hero. I threw things and I ran, and I got right out of there. My understanding is, being a former athlete, was that, you know, if a horse breaks its stride, the horse loses. If you're running a marathon, you focus on 1 mile at a time. You don't look at the total effect. And so I realized my mind, in a sense, failed me, because I was seeing something I shouldn't see, and I didn't really know how to handle that. And I remember running down the hallway screaming, because the fear of losing control of my environment was a devastating one for me. And I was very fortunate back in that time that there were people around who were willing to consider the possibility that something was happening, or if not that, cared enough about me to be with me through it.
Chris, did everything happen in the dorm room?
Initially, yes. For the first 3 or 4 weeks, everything seemed to circulate or happen in that dorm room, from opening doors, the breezes, things touching you, calling names, seeing the figure. After the priest came to bless the room, then the haunting spread to different parts of the building and different buildings on the campus.
You kind of chased him away.
Well, yeah, the priest had said, you know, I'm here for two people. You know, I'm here for you and for whatever this thing is. And the blessing was designed to put the spirit to rest. And part of that, what he said was, you can't be here anymore. You know, you have to go someplace else. This is not a place that you're welcome. And it was great, because for 3 days, nothing happened anywhere. And I didn't quite understand how a blessing works, if there's some kind of intent, or if it's a prayer, or if it's an understanding I didn't have, but I was pleased. And then 3 days later, the attacks began, and the attacks were severe, and they were swift.
You said you saw this thing. Kind of describe it for us.
Absolutely. It looked like a human being, a young male, possibly 15, 20. If I didn't see the legs going through the stereo, I would have thought someone was standing in my room.
Mm-hmm.
I can make out a blue and yellow on the torso, a blue clothing on the legs. I could see the eyes, the mouth. So but the legs going through the stereo was the kicker for me to think this isn't right.
I'm not going to say you were wrong to do this, but why did you run out?
I think that I wanted to have maintain control of my emotions. You know, if anybody out there listening to your show has competed in any type of sport competitively, regardless of the score or the mile or what's happening, you have to stay in your game and stay focused. And you know, I had run marathons, 9 marathons, and you know, every step is accounted for, every carbohydrate, everything you do. And when I saw that, it was the first time in my life I can recall thinking, I can't control this. I can't understand this. I could be in danger. And, you know, we have flight and we have fight for fear. What I did was I froze. And in my experience is flight and fright aren't the first things. The first thing is freezing because your mind has to take stock of what's happening because the wrong action could be the bad action. So I think we freeze first. And I froze. I looked at this thing for probably 30, 40 seconds. And then when I realized that I wasn't being resolved, I was still seeing it, my choice then was to flee.
Was it looking at you, trying to lunge at you? What was happening?
It was standing right in the corner of the room. His head was tilted to the left. His mouth was open a bit, and he was just staring right at me. And, you know, if you can imagine if you're in your house and you look up and someone's in your room we don't recognize, that's scary as it is. But then to have the facilities, the capability to go through an object like a stereo or a couch, that's devastating. And I think that, you know, if you ever had a break-in into your home or something like that, it gives you stress. And so that every night you lock your door twice, lock your window twice for fear of it happening again. When you're in a college dorm room and you really can't go anyplace else and there's nothing else you can do, but you can't call the police, then you live in fear of that thing just coming back. And I suppose if it just looked and left, it'd be one thing, but it stayed. I mean, it would talk, and there'd be frightening times where I'd wake up from my sleep, and it'd be looking right at me, breathing my breath out of my mouth. And again, that to me is terrifying. And
well, I wouldn't want to wake up to that. That's for sure.
Right.
Anybody witnessed this, or were you the only one?
Oh, it became a very well spoken of or shared event within the dorm over time. My first roommate, his name was Paul. He left. He left the college that semester because of the haunting, you know, and he saw the same thing I did. In fact, I tried not to describe the ghost to anyone because then that would predispose them to possibly seeing what I saw, and I didn't want any kind of mass hysteria or any kind of, you know, loss of credibility with what I was saying. And the night after I saw this person standing in the room, he woke me up saying there's someone in the room with their head tilted looking at me, which matched my exact, you know, experience, and I knew that it was something external, and I knew that it was something that we probably in some way have to deal with it, whether we wanted to or not.
And Chris, at this point, nothing bad is happening to you, right?
No, nothing was bad in the sense that there was no damage. There were frightening things, where the door of a closet would open up, where the picture frames would be taken apart, where furniture would move. You know, you'd hear whispering, then my name being called.
But nothing aimed at hurting you.
Nothing that I could tell you was anything that was aggressive or, you know, I mean.
Were you able to find out at that point if a student had died there or something had happened?
Well, I think that's a great assumption at that point, because if the neck was indeed tilted or head tilted, that could have possibly been maybe the neck had been snapped.
Maybe a suicide?
Right, maybe there was a suicide. And I think, you know, many places have stories about suicides or a lady in white or Indian burial grounds. And I didn't really pay much attention. I make a joke that back then, for me, ghosts were Casper the Friendly Ghost and Jesus and nothing in between. You know, so I didn't pay much heed to things people said. But that was the working understanding that we developed over time, is that probably someone had killed themselves in that room. And either because of fate or because maybe I had some sensitivity, it chose to speak to me. I can tell you, though, that I wasn't necessarily intent on trying to understand who it was or why it was there, in all honesty. I was trying to survive it and escape it, and that's the fact of the situation.
Were you ever able to confirm if somebody did commit suicide in that room?
I actually went later in that semester up to the police station in Geneseo, and they allowed me to go, you know, confidentially some of the files, and there was somebody who committed suicide, you know, in that general area, a few years before. And so that, again, led me to believe that perhaps this was the case. But not necessarily knowing that, I didn't want to say anything that might be incorrect, because people sometimes build off of your words or build off of your evidence. And if the evidence or words are incorrect, then you build a false construct. And, you know, being that I like science, I didn't want that to happen. So I tried to keep an open mind. Some people thought perhaps one of my runs in the countryside, I picked one up. Maybe the Warrens brought it. Maybe, you know, so I tried not to cement any kind of understanding early on. It wasn't until 25 years later, when the sci-fi show came calling, where they said to me, listen, you really owe it to yourself to try to find out who this was, what this was, not just for the purpose of the show, but for closure. And 25 years later, we began to look back at what could have happened and who it might have been.
At what point did the attacks start occurring?
Yes, the priest, Father Charles Manning, was very kind. We had brought to him the notes that Jeff was writing, because I asked he keep a record of the daily occurrences. And we brought these to him, Paul and I, and he read them, and he said, "No, I believe you, but just let me just make sure that you're not doing drugs, you're not drinking alcohol, because that'd be a different kind of problem." Once he established that there was no, you know, intoxication going on here or any inebriation, he agreed to help. So he came to the room, he blessed it. And as I said, for 3 days, things were great. Then on March 10th, I'd gone for a long run in the countryside, and I was taking a shower. And I saw a shadow, a silhouette of a head, neck, and torso, tilted, of course, across the bathroom ceiling. And the scary thing was this: there's no light source on the there's no light source on the floor, it's on the ceiling. So any shadow goes in the ground, so there couldn't be a shadow on the ceiling. And so I thought, oh no, maybe the thing is back. And so I stepped out into the bathroom, no one was there. I came back in, turned the water off, and then that was the first attack. I felt like I was stabbed in the back. I swung, I tore the shower curtain down, and I ran in the middle of the bathroom, and I said, you know, who are you? You know, what are you? Show yourself. What are you? And then I looked in the mirror, and I saw I had these three scratches that were bubbling already with blood. Jeez. From my neck down to my waist. And I remember looking in the mirror thinking, oh, that poor guy. And, of course, that poor guy was me. And I fell on the ground, and I thought, well, that's it. You know, what can I do? It's going to attack me. I can't defend myself. And the most amazing thing happened right then, where as I lay there on the ground, I saw one drop of water hanging off my wrist. And in that drop of water, I could see the inverted reflection of the floor. I thought, that's what happens, refraction, water refracts the light. Check, that's science. The water dropped to the ground. Check, gravity, that's what happens, that makes sense. And that droplet of water darkened the grout between the tile. Moisture, check. And so I began to put my mind back together again, piece by piece, to say, this is really happening. But I realized that to do this every day would be so exhausting mentally, I probably couldn't keep doing it.
Was this an important moment for you, this attack, this shower episode?
Yeah, at the time, I would have told you that this is the worst moment of my life. Looking back, it was very illuminating. It taught me about myself, about my belief systems, and about the courage to forge ahead when you think you can't. And a lot of times when you look at people we think are heroes, like a Helen Keller, for example, these are people who forge beyond limitation. And they inspire us to do the same. And I think that at that moment when I was able to challenge myself to move forward again, I think that was a big moment for me as a person.
At any point, Chris, did other entities or apparitions come into the room?
I don't believe so. Of course, it's certainly possible. And being that I wasn't like today's ghost hunters where they bring their K2 meters and they analyze data.
It was just little old you.
That's just it, you know. And so, is it possible? It sure is. Can I say with certainty? I really can.
All right. When we come back in a moment, it's more on surviving evidence with Christopher DeChesire. His websites, of course, doesn't have that, but he's got Facebook, and we've got that linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. We'll be back in a moment talking more about this extreme haunting. Okay, here we are talking about the incredible case, the surviving evidence, memoir of an extreme haunting by Christopher DeChesire. Christopher, are you French? Is that French?
I believe it's Latin. It comes from the phrase from Caesar.
From Caesar it is. Very well done. And tell me about the cover. Is that you?
That is me. Yeah, that's it's always awkward to see yourself on something, but that's and if you look at the cover, the bottom left-hand side, you'll see there's a bit of a spine that's taken from the ghost photograph, and
Yeah.
to the bottom right, there's when I was 19 when the ghost was coming toward me. So it's a beautiful job, and that was designed by a woman named Mara Katria, the
Very
British
well
health
done.
guard.
Very well. There was a ghost photo, a skeletal ghost image here.
Right.
Tell me about that and how that popped up.
Absolutely. You know, not everybody wanted the priest to come to bless the room because some folks thought it's amazing to have a ghost in the location.
And it was fun, right?
We could talk to it. Maybe we could find out about life and death. Is there a heaven or a hell? Would this change religion? So there was some pressure to say, just tell him not to come. But I wanted to eat and to drink and to sleep, and so I didn't want to have to suffer anymore. And the thought was, well, before the priest got there, let's get some evidence that at least we know it was here. And I was a bit nervous about that, but one of the key people who was involved in trying to advocate for evidence was Jeff Unger, who wrote the journal notes. And he said, let's go in there, let's see if we can talk this thing, get some pictures of it before the priest sends it away. And I agreed. And it was interesting in that when the ghost was in that room, once again, I could see him as though he were standing right there. At that point in time, Jeff couldn't see him. And so I said, Jeff, he's right there. And Jeff looked and didn't see anything. I said, the ghost, the dead thing, that's him. Take his picture. It was almost comical. And I don't see it, Chris, so he said to me. He said, if you see it, take the camera. You take the camera. You take the picture. And I did. I said, I'll take one picture, and I zipped out of that room. And back in those days, there's no digital photos. You had to go to one of our photo booths or send it away. And when Jeff got the photo back, we noticed right where I pointed, right where I said, was this skeletal image of like a human skeleton there. And that was terrible for me because whereas people say, that's great evidence, for me it was different. I didn't want it there. So imagine if you think your spouse is cheating on you. You might hire someone to follow her or him around to see what the proof is. And you hope that really it's nothing. It's some kind of club they're going to. But if a guy comes back and says to you, here's your evidence, here's your pictures, do you want to see them for sure? Do you really want to see what's on there? You're mixed about it. And so for me, not wanting to go on, every time we got evidence, I didn't want to see it. I didn't want to know about it because it reminded me of something that's terrible. So whereas most people thought, that's incredible, show the picture to everyone, I wanted to burn it. I wanted to get rid of it, so I never thought about these things again. I was very close-minded about that. My need to want to be healthy and survive overtook the overall perspective of finding information and understanding the world around me. But again, as a teenager, I wasn't prepared for this to happen.
When you got the scratches on your back in the shower,
yes.
At what point did it become even more serious?
Right. You know, if it's just yourself involved in a crisis, it is a little easier to manage that, even if it's very difficult emotionally on you or physically. However, after that attack occurred, this spirit, this ghost, began to terrorize people I cared about. And the interesting thing about that is, looking back, when the priest blessed that room, again, how it works, I don't understand, but it stayed out of my room, it began to go to people's rooms who I knew. And they would tell me, Chris, it's bothering me, it's holding me down in my bed, it's grabbing my leg. And so they brought me to their rooms, which did what? It brought me to the ghost. I thought, wow, that's very clever. But when you see people you care about in terror, when you see people, you know, screaming, running back and forth, and you think, oh my gosh, did I do something wrong? Wasn't I proactive enough? And maybe I should get more involved in this. And in fact, things really came to a head when one of my friends said, listen, my roommate keeps hearing this thing, call your name in his head. And he really could probably talk to you and use your help with this. And I said, look, I don't even know how to help myself. I don't think I can help him. And very tragically, he ended up taking his own life.
Oh, my gosh.
So it wasn't, you know, a lot of times you watch a movie on TV or in the theater, and it's a fire ghost or has wings, it's a demon, and you get your axe or your cross, you fight it off, and then everyone goes home. For us, it wasn't about any kind of, you know, trying to show anything or trying to survive. And, you know, when you internalize these moments and you lose people and people are suffering, no matter what you believe about ghosts or not, you need to help. You know, a good person helps. I was raised that way. And so those are the things, my friends suffering and being hurt, that made me say, you know what, I really need to do what I can to somehow resolve this.
Well, this wasn't getting fun at all at this point, was it?
No, you know, it's for me, it never was. And now that some people have read the book, and because of the sci-fi show and things, people sometimes invite me to conferences. And a lot of times there's what they call a celebrity ghost hunt. And that's part of the package when they bring you in.
Sure.
And it's tough for me because my experience was so traumatic that I'm not sure I want to go into a place and see other ghosts. My experience was it attached itself to me. It wouldn't leave for months. People I knew were hurt or worse. And so for me, it's interesting to try to balance the understanding of the search for meaning, the search for, conclusions versus survival. And I get both sides. I was a skeptic. I went through a trauma, and now guess what? I can't be a skeptic, but I understand trying to keep a balance between the mind and the heart.
You even began to name this entity, didn't you?
Yeah, it's very interesting. For some reason, and I don't know how it happened, something's just working away, people began to call this ghost Tommy. Somebody because, Tommy, can you hear me?
That's my producer's name, by the way. That's what
That's a
we
bad
call
name.
him. We call him that around here. Oh, I knew he was a ghost. I
See,
knew
now
it.
you have evidence. That's just having evidence right there, my friend. But, for me, Jeff was telling me to call the ghost out, call the ghost. And he said, well, call his name. And I said, I don't know his name. I see it. I throw things, I scream, and that's our relationship. There's no Christmas cards being exchanged, And so he said, feel for the name. I don't have feel for a name, so just pick a name. I said, Thomas. I had a parakeet named Thomas. But ironically, almost every person began to call this thing Tommy or Thomas independently. And that was very interesting. And, years and years later, when we began to look at who this might have been, the prime candidate was a person named Thomas or Tommy.
That's interesting. Other than the scratches, Christopher, I'm not hearing anything that would lead me to believe that you were in any danger. Yet, you're pretty still scared around this situation, aren't you?
Well, absolutely. People react to situations in different ways, and we all have our images. You're a jock, a brain, a stoner, a geek. You put labels on yourself sometimes by default. But when these things happen, there's no time to dress a certain way or plan out what you're going to say. It's just you react as who you are, for better or for worse. And for me, I discovered early on, I'm not cut out for this. I like to play baseball. I like to run. I like to, eat ice cream. I'm not that I'm simple. I just like to enjoy my life and to have this dead thing hovering around calling my name. It wasn't something that I don't think I was built for. Ironically, I think maybe that my self-doubt led me to learn more and to persevere longer than I would have otherwise and invest in it so that I actually probably, looking back, did a decent job of trying to work through it.
Tell me about these ghost tapes.
Yeah, the parapsychologist, Dr. Lawrence Kassler, he recommended that we get more proofs. And again, proof wasn't what I was looking for, but some people around me really thought that's valuable moving forward, and I understood.
Sure.
And so
Even for
he
your own
said,
sanity, it's important.
well, you're right, and sometimes you can play something back and get something more from it than just hearing it on your own. And again, I was terrified, but since the priest blessed the room, we had to go to some of the girls' rooms in the B building because they seemed to be active there at that moment. And so we brought in this old-fashioned cassette tape recorder, and we locked the doors and the windows. And Jeff was very big there. Beth was there, Linda. And we just set everything, and I spoke into the box. I said, listen, this box will save your words. If you keep saying, calling my name, you want me to help you, this is your chance. So you talk into this box when I leave. When I get back, do not be here. I will throw things at you. And so we'll be back in, say, 15 minutes. So we would lock the door. Jeff would give us the key. He'd put a chair in front of the door and sit there. We'd take the key away and sit like 20 feet away. We'd wait 15 minutes to go back in. And we'd go in, and the closet would be open. The desk would be moved. The chairs would be changed. It'd be freezing in there. And so we knew. And we wound the tape. And first there was nothing. Then we heard the chair pull out. We heard breathing like that. And then we heard the voice. And, it would sound something like, and I can't do it. I'm not a ghost. But, something along the lines of, help me, help. Just this
A
plaintive
guttural
wail for help.
sound, as you
And
call it.
again, that was met by most people with success. This is crazy good. Now we have the video, now we have the audio, now we have the proof is just really coming out nicely. But there I am sitting on the floor in this dark room thinking, oh dear God, I can't even be in the same room as it. It attacked me. I run from it. Now it's saying it wants my help. And now I said to it, talk in the box, I'll help you. How am I going to do this? It's almost as though I'm walking on this dark road, and a small child is drowning in a pond, and it sees me, and I see the child. The problem is I can't swim. Do I risk my life and go in there and drown with the child? Or do I just walk away, let it suffer for eternity?
You
So,
can't walk away.
yeah, and I didn't. You're absolutely right. Good person doesn't do that, George.
Nope. No, you can't. It's frustrating. It's probably scary for somebody who doesn't know how to swim, but you're going to do whatever you have to do. Maybe a branch, who knows what, to
right.
try to save somebody.
Absolutely.
These series of hauntings, what was the time period? How long did they last, Chris?
Well, my best guess as far as the start would be around February 11th or February 12th. We didn't necessarily document the very beginning, not knowing what it was. But it went through to approximately April 20th or 21st. That's about the time I decided to take matters into my own hands. I decided to break the priest's blessing, to go in that room, get the candle like he used, and invite the ghost back in. And the reason I did that is because when I asked the priest, can the ghost get back in the room, he had said to me, only if you invite him back in. And I said, that will never happen. So there I was, ironically, a month and a half later.
You brought him back in.
Yes, of course.
Did it come back in?
Absolutely. But it was terrifying. The intent to do something is sometimes different than the actual reality of doing it, you know? And so in my mind, I would call this thing back in the room. I would talk to it, and it's resolved. However, it's kind of like a roller coaster. It looks very cool from far away. That's a great ride. Then you get on the roller coaster, they strap you in the bar, you think, can I just get off real quick? I'm done. But you can't. Once you're on the ride, you're on the ride. And so I remember my friend named Craig Norris had told me, listen, just, you know, you go in the shower, take a hot shower, almost like a baptism, clean yourself off. You walk in that room in your birthday suit the way God made you, and you talk to it. I thought, what? Oh, all right. So I went to that room, I lit the candle, and I'm shivering from the water, and I just waited. And after about 3 to 4 minutes, which seemed like a half an hour, I saw the shadow on the wall coming towards me, and I knew. And I knew it was there, and the candle kind of it shivered and blew out, and I stood up waiting for it, and I looked to the right where I thought it would be, and of course it was to my left and scared the heck out of me, and there it was. And I looked, and again, it looked as though it was physical. It looked as I could almost see moisture on it, you know, and I could see skin, and I just tried to get my courage. I'm glad of one thing. It didn't smell bad. I think if it smelled like decomposition, I would have probably ran out and gotten sick, but it just smelled cold, which helped me stay in that room. And I said, listen, you want my help, and here I am. This is the time. You have to go. You know, why are you here? Where did you come from? And I asked him, where did you come from? And he said to me in this wail, he said, Danville. And there's a place called Danville, New York, with an S, not too far away.
And there's also a Danville, Illinois.
Yes, and a Danville, Pennsylvania. But at least I got a name. And I said, what happened? He said to me, pain, too much pain. I made a mistake, but that could be anything if you think about it. That could fit the hanging concept. That can fit almost any episode. In any event, I just tried to explain to him, listen, as nervous as I was, you have to leave. You have to find peace. You have to believe that somebody or something can forgive whatever it is you did, because you're hurting people, and you're hurting me, and people are dying, and this is only going to make things worse for you.
Did it listen?
I believe so. I had this thing I used to do. I used to count to 10. I learned it from my grandma when I was a little kid.
With your eyes shut.
Absolutely right. You know, it's amazing how...
Go away, go away. Please go away, right?
Yes, but, you know, sometimes even as an adult, you revert back to your childhood moments. I remember at one point in time when the ghost was in the room, I curled up under the covers in a ball with, like, an air hole for my mouth.
Yeah.
I mean, how stupid is that looking back? How vulnerable are you going to be?
Thinking again, that'll make the ghost go away.
Right. Meanwhile, you're the most vulnerable you possibly could be, like a fetus, you know. But in any event, yeah, I counted to 10, and I opened my eyes, and I didn't see it. And to the best of my knowledge, you know, nothing has happened in that room or with that spirit since.
Huh. Nothing.
Well, here's the thing. That was April 21st. The semester ended May 5th or 6th. So within 10 days, we were out. Jeff and I decided, because Jeff moved in the room after Paul had left, that we would, for our final year of college, live across the campus. We didn't want to go through an ordeal like this again. I'd walk by the building, but I wouldn't go in. And one of the things, too, was that the media came. The newspaper came, the press came, photographers came. I became called the ghost boy, and I would hide behind mailboxes. I would avoid the crowds, and so we wanted to stay away from it. And once I walked out of that dorm room on that May 6th, 1985, I didn't go back for 25 years for two reasons. Number one, what if I didn't do it right? and it's still there, still waiting for me.
It'd be interesting to see if other students subsequent to you talked about a ghost there.
It would be. And when I finally went back 25 years later for my reunion, they stuck us back in that place.
Same room, same room?
Same exact room. But instead of having keys, they have these cards now, these like sliding cards for locks. I'm old, so I don't understand what that
and
was.
And it was still C2D1?
Absolutely. And you know what's interesting? The room seemed small. It seemed clean and small and little. Unlike
They all look small when you go back.
Yeah.
Your old house when you were a kid, who you thought was a mansion, you looked at it and you went, I lived in that?
That's just it. It became epic in my mind, this huge place with this thing running through it. And yet it was a little small little place. And I think we slept under the beds, just in case, Jeff and I. And then we spoke for the first time about this publicly. And again, while I was going shopping or mowing my lawn, people were talking about it. I just didn't know this. And so when I spoke for the first time, it was to a packed auditorium. I thought, what is this? And apparently people found some, over the years, interest in this, and they began to investigate. And I spoke to one woman, a young lady, who claimed to have had an experience. She said that she was there a few years ago, had heard about what happened to me, and tried to call this spirit out, and that her boyfriend broke up with her, that there were cold breezes, that people got angry at her, she saw red and all these things. Now, of course, I can't verify that or not verify that, but that's what I've heard since in terms of possibilities. So, and I'm very hesitant to, comment on in terms of how accurate that is or not. That's her experience; it's authentic.
And why a sci-fi interest in doing the special show? Of course, the dorm room nightmare. So many years later.
Well, I guess because society accepts this now as a communication. Concept that, back in the day, it was The Exorcist, perhaps, and Poltergeist. That was it. It was just this horror realm. Now it seems as though people are willing to accept or understand this might be part of the fabric of reality. And I was speaking at Penn State University. I'd been giving a lecture there, and there were people from a show called Paranormal State.
Mm-hmm.
And afterwards, they said to me, Chris, you have to go on television. You have to tell this because we've been all over, and this is amazing. We've never seen anything or heard anything like this with what you went through and the evidences and things. And so I thought, of course, they're just being nice to me. And then sci-fi came a-calling a few months later.
Well, at this point now, here we are, all these years later, the book is out, Surviving Evidence. Where do you stand on the ghost? It's gone?
I believe it's gone. I don't believe it was malicious. I think that he was desperate.
Do you miss it?
Do I miss it? Oh, I wish I could give the theatrical answer and say, boy, do I miss it. We're so close. No, I hope it's at rest. I hope I never see it again. I hope that whatever I did gives it some sense of peace. And I don't mean to sound selfish about that. It's just that, in our lives, we have accomplishments we want to achieve. I'm a school teacher, and I want to have my students learn.
Yeah.
I'm a father. I want my children to grow up healthy and safe. I'm a husband. I'm a son. So I still take pleasure from the simple things in life.
Chris, we're going to take some phone calls with you next hour. Two kinds. I'd like for people to maybe share their similar stories. Maybe they had one like you or questions. You've gone through it. Maybe you can help them. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.